serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Tom Hidalgo, 97 years old. And for the last 10 of those years, he's lived in Creston, California, a beautiful spot near what's turned into wine country around Paso Robles. Before we're done, we're going to hear about the experience that Tom had with Honor Flight Central Coast, California, a trip to Washington, D.C. But right now, let's go back to the most brutal winter on record in Europe and what you experienced during the Battle of the Bulge with that 980th Field Artillery Battalion.
How cold did it get, and what was the worst thing you had to deal with that?
It got pretty cold, but not as cold as Korea, but it was cold.
Well, we'll have to get to that, too.
I think we had better equipment in Europe than the old worn-out equipment and worn-out vehicles that we got in Korea.
So in Europe, during the Bulge, what did you have to keep you warm? Did you have extra?
You had two blankets. And you had a sleeping bag. You had a good heavy overcoat. So you slept with everything you could. Overcoat and everything, you know, that was your nightgown.
I'm sure it never got that cold in Santa Barbara.
No, nothing like that. We never had snow.
And if you're on European soil for almost a year, I'm sure there are a lot of nights where you wish you could just go back to Santa Barbara and see Jenny again.
Oh, I was sure. The war was over, and a couple of days later, I'm told the truck's coming by early in the morning, pick you up, you're going to Holland. From Holland, you're going to get shipped back to Cherbourg, and then you're going home. And I came home in a little minesweeper.
Well, tell me about the moment when you got to see your wife again after all that time and all those close calls.
I landed in New Jersey. Of course, we boarded the train and we got shipped over here to Marysville, I think it's an Air Force base now, Camp Beale. And then I got separated there, put on a Greyhound bus and shipped home to Santa Barbara.
Was she waiting for you at the station?
No, because she didn't know I was coming in. Once we got off the ship, we weren't allowed to talk to anybody, tell them where we were going or how soon we were going. So she didn't know I was coming home. And when I got to Beale, we weren't allowed to use the telephones or call home. Or I got put on the Greyhound bus and landed to Santa Barbara early in the morning, called a taxi cab there, and he took me a roundabout way to increase my fare and took me home.
So what was her reaction when she saw you?
Well, everybody was surprised as all get out, you know. Of course, I was probably more surprised because I came home and the wife now had a baby, had my oldest boy.
Had she written you letters about that? You knew she was expecting?
My aunt wrote to me on one of those V-mail or email one-sheet deal. She sent it to me while I was in England and told me that wife had a baby boy. So I knew about that. But the Red Cross didn't notify me till I was over in St. Mary Glees there before they notified me.
Well, I want people to grasp this here, because you said, when I asked you about getting married before you went overseas, right? You said, well, that gave me something to come home for. But now I'm understanding for the first time here, the whole time that you're in combat, you're fighting with the awareness that you have a son that you're never going to meet unless you survive.
That's right. That's right. And then it seemed like the Army did all they could to keep me from seeing him till I got home.
What was that like, to lay eyes on your son?
By the time I got home about, say, 7 o'clock in the morning after the trip from Beale, my father had already gone to work when the taxi cab dropped me off in front of the house. They immediately called my father, and of course, he came home from work too. He's glad to see me home.
Well, and I'm not trying to be melodramatic here, but I have to imagine that all that time in Europe, there had to be at least a day or two where you wondered if you'd ever get to meet your son.
Oh, yes, constantly.
So to finally hold him in your arms.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed my stay because when I wasn't on duty, going through France and Paris, I stopped at the Selmer factory, picked me up a buffet clarinet. I brought that home, and my daughter lives in Reno. She has it now. So I misappropriated from the Selmer plant. And
spoils of war. You know, I didn't really ask you, but I'm sure they exist. If you were in Europe for that long in this field artillery battalion, you must have experienced some close calls that you can look back on now and say, boy, that's hard to believe I survived that.
I'd like to go back sometime. I just went back to Washington, D.C. on that Central Coast flight. I'd really like to go back and see that old church at St. Mary Gleason and see some. Cherbourg, I'm too old, I guess, to go back now.
I don't think so. You're in great shape. But tell me this. Maybe it's not fun to think about or easy, but if you had to pick one moment from your time in combat that you would say was your closest call or the closest you came to not coming home, to not seeing your wife, to not meeting your son, what do you think that was?
Because of the compaction of the fighting going on there on the Cherbourg Peninsula, I think that was the closest infighting that we actually got to. After that, the St. Louis breakthrough, and we kept pushing the enemy, and they kept retreating, and we were pursuing them all the time. We were carrying the fight to them. They were carrying outside of the Bulge. That was the only deal where they actually started to penetrate.
And I realized that being in the artillery is different from being on the front lines with the infantry. But when you're with the artillery, you're also a target because they want to take out your artillery. Did you guys deal with incoming artillery shells or tree bursts or anything?
Sure. They tried to knock us out, and we're trying to knock their artillery out. And they had wonderful armaments. Hitler did something for them. He really had good weapons. Their tanks were far superior to ours.
Can you give us an example of when their artillery or tank fire was coming towards you? And how close that was and how you had to deal with it?
Their 88s were continuously harassing us. They were hunting for us, so we kept moving. We were right in with the infantry. I mean, people seemed to feel that the artillery's way in the rear. Well, no, you exploit your range and you move as close to the front as you can so that you can penetrate deep within them. Hit them before they get organized to attack, break up their formations before.
Did you have to deal with losing friends over there, losing guys that you knew or had become close to?
Most of the friends that I lost were, I'd say, mostly their own fault, not following procedure, being where they weren't supposed to be, not because they were there on a defensive measure. They went up there without authority to be there. They were sightseers, or most of those people. Of course, some of them were legitimate casualties, but a lot of them were self-inflicted because they were there where they weren't supposed to be.
What would you say was the hardest thing to deal with, the hardest thing that you had to survive or endure?
I don't really know. I wasn't in a fight for combat for survival. I managed the computations of the firing data to launch our projectiles, and that was what I did all day long and sometimes all night long.
And when I asked you about the Bulge and how cold it was, you said it was cold but not as bad as Korea. So give me a snapshot of what you did in Korea and what you had to endure there.
In Korea, it was real cold, and we didn't have the equipment. It seemed to have been leftovers. The Jeeps had all the floorboards out of them, and we used shell cratings to put the floorboards down because everything was rotten. That equipment wasn't coming back. It was going to stay in Korea. So we weren't equipped like we were when we were in Germany.
But your duties were similar?
Very much. I wasn't in the fire direction in Korea. I was kind of a surveyor. I plotted out the and surveyed in our front lines, picked out where the enemy was, surveyed in the 38th parallel so that when we left there, we knew where North Korea was going to start and where South Korea started. That was my job in Korea.
You know, and you stayed in through the Cold War and through the Vietnam War. What were you doing for those years?
Because of my age, I didn't have to go to Vietnam, but I trained troops, reservists, and Fort Irwin and Fort Lewis.
And you mentioned that you had the chance a couple years ago to go to Washington, D.C. with Central Coast Honor Flight out of San Luis Obispo And when you go there, you see the World War II Memorial that honors 406,000 Americans who died. And then you go to the Korean War Veterans Memorial, and more than 50,000 died there, and so many are still missing. And then you go to the Vietnam Wall, where there's the names of 58,000 men and probably some guys that you trained. What was that whole experience to go to those three spots on that trip? What was that like for you?
I appreciated the fact that somebody thought about a lot of us guys who fought in these wars and never got a chance to see Arlington, to see all the graves there that are back as far as Civil War, you know. So it was something that I never thought I'd ever see.
Was there one moment or one spot on that trip that meant the most to you?
I don't think I had any preference of all. It was all very interesting. And say, well, this is what we fought for.
And who went with you on that trip?
I took my number two son.
Well, I'm just imagining, and I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth. But I'm thinking while you're at that National World War II Memorial and you're looking at that wall of gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who died, who didn't come home from the war like you did, and you're standing there with your number two son who wouldn't have been born if you were one of those stars. Was it emotional for you at the World War II Memorial?
Oh, yes, it was. It was. In fact, as we had a police escort, they just swept the traffic off both sides of the road, and they just opened up, and we went barreling down the highway. Everything was right on time.
That must have made you feel pretty important.
Yes, it did. It made me feel like somebody had put an effort to try and make our trip enjoyable and paramount importance.
Well, if there's anything else that you want to say, I want you to feel free to do so, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. Is there something that you would say as you look back after 35 years in the Army and now 97 years old that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm proud that I got to serve my country.
Why do you fly that American flag so high in front of your house here in Creston?
Well, after I got out of the service, I went to work for a university at Santa Barbara, UCSB. I was on the Chancellor's Council. I only put 10 years of service at UCSB, but when I retired after 10 years, they gave me that flag. That flag flew for the Olympic Games, that flagpole, and so they gave me that flag as going away retirement deal. And so I had to hire a special truck to haul that flagpole up here, and I put it out there in my front yard. Now I have Jehovah's Witnesses come by, and they want me to take the flag down. I said, I'm not taking it down. I said, it's my country. I said, I'm a Hispanic. I said, but I was born in this country. And my parents were born in this country. So I said, it's my flag. I don't have any other.
And he'll keep flying it high. I've got a picture of it for you at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That is Tom Hidalgo. What a remarkable journey he's been on for the last 97 years. That's our program for today. Thanks for spending the hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.